All right, here we go. We are live with the one, the only, Mr. John Scalzi. I did try to put a little bit of bio together for you real quick, and then I realized that if I included all of your bibliography and all of your awards, it was going to be really, really long. So I have done a short version, and then I'm going to let you have a chance to add anything you might have wanted to add. Anybody who doesn't know who you are obviously has never gone through the science fiction section. You got the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer for Old Man's War, which is probably your best known work. You've gotten multiple Hugo Awards, including the best novel for Red Shirts, multiple Locus Awards, including the best science fiction novel for the Kaiju Preservation Society, which was my gateway drug to you. Absolutely love that book. And then you also received the Robert A. Heinlein Award for, and this may be the longest award name I've ever heard, Outstanding Published Works in Science Fiction and Technical Writings to Inspire the Human Exploration of Space. Anything you'd like to add to that long list?
No, I think that pretty much does it for me. I'm trying to think of what else there might possibly be. And I think you pretty much got it.
I was trying not to make it too long.
Yeah. No, I did I was a film critic beforehand. I worked for AOL and I just did a number of other things. So but for functionally for what we're doing now, all of that works. I'm hearing a little bit of an echo. Are you hearing an echo at all?
Maybe just a hair, but not very much. It's not affecting anything, I don't think.
Okay.
At least on my end.
I'm getting basically like a 5-second delay. Yeah. So.
Okay. Is it just me that you're hearing, or is it you?
No, it's both of us. And so that's kind of weird. I'm wondering if it's.
Do you by any chance have it open somewhere?
I don't know. I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go ahead and go very quickly and grab some microphones and or some headphones. And I think that will probably help.
Let me see if I just fixed it.
Okay.
Do you still hear the echo?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I am so full of technical problems. I came in late because the URL that I was sent had HTML weird encoding in it. So I'm just the problem child here. This is me, not you. All right, hold on.
And in my defense, he did say that was the URL he was sent by the publicist, not the one from me. The one from me worked.
No. I mean, that's I'm not blaming you for that at all. Okay, all right. No, I'm still getting the delay.
So. And you don't app? Do you by any chance have the YouTube up right now? Like, do you have that up as well as the StreamYards?
Oh, you know what? I'm again the problem. That was exactly what it was. Thank
don't
you
feel bad, Paul. I had the same issue with Paul Jessup one time, and then he realized that he still had the thing up from before it started. So
you
I
know
was just thinking that because you messaged me inside of YouTube. I'm like, I bet he still has YouTube open.
Oh, man, you know, this is making me feel like the most like old person that I've ever felt like in ever. Like, usually I'm the tech person at home. You know, my mother-in-law laws like, why is this happening, and I will solve it for her. And just today has been cursed, but all our problems are solved now. All everything right. is working, and I'm ready to go.
I'm so sorry for
those of you who are watching me be incompetent right now.
If it makes you feel any better, Liz Hand did a whole thing for me for a horror rec author thing, and then she had to come back because I hadn't hit start recording. So she was so nice to come back on for that. That was, because she was so good the first time, and I felt bad having her make it go through the whole thing again.
Yeah. Well, the good news is that we've just done the preliminary stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, we've just talked about, you know, who I am and all my little thingies. So now we're ready for the actual meat of the conversation.
Perfect. Well, the first question I like to ask every author, a lot of people like to want to write. A lot of people love the idea of being an author. Very few people actually go through it and pull it off. So, what is the John Scalzi supervillain origin story?
I mean, for me, it was literally, I decided at 14 that I was going to be a writer and I didn't give myself a backup plan. So, for me, there was no other option. I grew up pretty poor. So the idea that, you know, there would be any margin if I messed up was fairly low. And so basically I just, you know, started on day one as deciding to be a writer, also being a little bit of a hustler. Now, I gave myself an edge in the 80s and 90s, which is when I was coming up, by not actually being a creative writer. I was working as a journalist and doing freelance work and things like that. So there were opportunities to actually make money as opposed to creative work, which is always kind of a little bit more difficult. So I was writing movie reviews and music reviews and entertainment interviews and just a whole bunch of stuff. I did, you know, my first several books were actually nonfiction books. I did a book on personal finance. I did a book on astronomy. I did a couple books on humor. I did a book on science fiction film. So all of that meant that when I started writing fiction, I was already in a pretty good place financially that made it easy to accept that when one started off in the fiction realm, one didn't get paid too much. My day job was also writing, so that really helped.
Perfect, perfect. Another thing I like to ask just for people, because a lot of people who watch these type of things, it's not just the fans. A lot of them are very aspiring authors.
Mm-hmm.
Or you as a writer, what does a day in the life of John Scalzi look like?
So basically, if I am writing a novel or other major project, what I do try to do is basically there's 4 hours where I'll just be like, turn off the internet, and just focus on what I'm supposed to be doing. And I usually have that guideline of about 4 hours a day or about 2000 words. Cause as a former journalist, I can type pretty quickly and the words come out pretty quickly. And if I hit one or the other, usually I stop for the day. If I hit 4 hours and I'm not like, at 2,000 words, I don't panic about it because some days are slower. If I've written 2,000 words, usually at that point, I'm somewhere close to a place where I can stop for the day anyway. So I won't necessarily hit exactly 2,000. I might be 21 or 2,200 words. But usually that's enough where I feel like there's been some solid progress forward. But I also don't feel like my brain is completely deflated. And that is important because, especially now as I'm 55, I'm going to be 56 this year. And I'm not as spry, as I used to be, mentally. And so, it makes sense for me to, basically leave a little headroom, in my brain for, being able to do other things and also to plan ahead for the next day of writing. So those are the two things that I usually do. And then once I'm done with the writing, because I usually do it first before I do anything else, because if you let the world in, the world will impinge on you. But after that, I will do all the emails that I have to do that are business related. I will take care of other projects that I might need to do. But at this point, the writing the novels is the day job. So that is the thing that always takes priority, no matter what else I'm doing. If I don't write novels, I don't eat. So it's time to make sure you have time for writing. And I do think that the repetition of it is important. I used to tell people write every day, but I think that that's less important than writing regularly and giving your brain basically, to mix metaphors, the muscle memory to be like, all right, my butt's in the chair. It's time for me to write. And if you do that on a regular basis, whatever it is, then it's going to be easier just to write. You don't have to worry about getting into the mood because putting your butt in the chair just sort of automatically puts you into the mood.
Perfect. And I think you've got you sparked an idea there. If you ever have any issues and you can't think of something new, I think you've already got a setup plan for the writer's block diet plan. I think that would be possibly a bestseller there. You write, you can't eat. All right. And then one last thing before we get into the book, I always like to ask authors, if you had to teach a class, and it could be on any topic, but it was for aspiring authors, and it's either something that you learned that made life easier for you, or something that if you'd learned earlier might have made life easier for you, what would you talk about?
Oh, I've done this. I was instructor at Viable Paradise, and I also did a stint at Clarion 1 year. And the thing that I would talk about that I don't think gets talked about enough is actually the business aspect of writing, which is not about per se how much you're getting paid per word or anything like that, although that is actually important. But all the other things, you know, the intellectual property aspect of it, the issues of setting up your financial life so that you have the time and space available to do the writing, the things that you need to be aware of in terms of, in the United States, at least, the taxes. Like, the thing that will whack a lot of writers is having to pay quarterly taxes, right? And just laying out the fact that when you set up shop as a writer, you are actually setting up shop. You are actually making a small business. And one of the most pernicious and dangerous things I think happens with writers, particularly creative writers, is they're like, well, I'm doing this for the art. You know, the business is a secondary aspect of this. And my feeling about that is, one, you are setting yourself up to be taken advantage of by a lot of people for whom this is their business, and they're more than happy to let someone be soft and fuzzy about the business end of it, so they can take advantage of you. And the other thing is, you know, quite frankly, all the things that you want to do as a writer are best achieved by having a solid business plan or a business understanding, because that's the milieu that we work in. Almost everything gets written for the stream of commerce. And so understanding that gives you more freedom, not less, as a writer, because you have the ability to take care of your own stuff. And so that is the thing that I always do, because I think other people can handle craft. Other people have been really good at handling the motivation for writing. But the thing that I have been consistently good at over and over again, year in, year out, is saying, it's a business. Let's take care of it as a business.
Perfect. Yeah, I think not even just writers, I think everybody wants to be their own boss.
Yeah.
Until they also have to be their own HR department or their own tax preparer,
own
marketer.
It's the absolute worst. I mean, the thing is I was very, very fortunate, and I actually have this as a thing, is I am very fortunate that my spouse, Christine, is very much has a business mind, she would be the first to admit, not a creative bone in her body, but keeping track of contracts, keeping track of payments, making sure everything is done business-wise. She is on top of that. It bothers her when it's not done. So she, you know, is like, give it to me, let me do it. And I'm like, okay. So in that respect, I can do all those things, but she can do them better. And so having that spouse who, you know, has her mind on the money and, you know, money on her mind, has been incredibly helpful. And I have always been very, very open to that. About the idea that the amount of success that I have had in a very great portion is due to the fact that I have a spouse who does handle the business end of things, that allows me to do, you know, long-term planning and the creative stuff. It's a good business team. So if you can get yourself a spouse who has a business brain, excellent.
Always helps to have that built-in person
there. Yes, absolutely.
By the way, anybody who is not following John Scalzi on Instagram and Blue Sky, you need to do that. I'll just throw that out there. By the way, I can tell by the color of our cans, I think I like the cherry version, but I feel like we have similar choices in soda there.
Yeah, no, the thing is around age 30, all of a sudden I was like, oh, I need to switch to diet because otherwise it will be a problem. This is basically, I don't drink coffee. So this is basically my caffeine intake. And so usually Coke Zero, sometimes the Cherry Coke Zero, which you have. They just now re-released the Orange Cream Coke Zero. And I
haven't tried that one yet.
I'm so happy. If you are of an age that we are, because I think we're probably of a similar age.
Yeah, I'm just a couple of years behind you. I mean, barely.
Yeah, yeah. So it will remind you of St. Joseph's chewable aspirin the first time you drink it. But because it's that vague orange flavored children's aspirin. But it is, but I love it. I think it tastes great. It tastes like a creamsicle mixed with a Coke. So.
I think when I ever got the vitamins, is always like the, or no, I did not the aspirin. I think I had the, there was an orange flavored one, but I don't think it was orange cream.
Yeah.
I do remember an orange flavored one though, from when I was.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's the one.
Maybe that is it. Maybe it's just, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
it's been years.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem with the flavor. We're going far afield, but you know, welcome.
We'll get back to the book in a second.
Yeah. The thing about a lot of the, you know, when they mix, like they just did the spiced Coke Zero and the spiced Coca-Cola, which didn't work. They were like, this is permanent. And then they pulled it. It's basically because it was made with raspberry. And the only thing that we use raspberry for in the United States is cough medicine. So every time people drank it, they're like, I'm drinking carbonated cough medicine, and I don't like that at all.
Yeah, so, I tried it. I didn't like that one.
Yeah, it just wasn't. It just didn't work. I wanted it to work because I'm a big fan of raspberry, but no, it just doesn't work. Anyway,
last thing, since it's not sponsored, I will say I do love the fact that Coke has come out with the zero stuff because I did not like the Diet Coke.
No, well, and there's a reason for that. I'm sorry, you have got onto one of my favorite bugaboos, which is the Diet Coke formula is actually the new Coke formula. It doesn't taste like Coke, whereas Coke Zero is the original Coke formula. And that is why I think it's been as successful as it has been. I mean, Diet Coke is now established and there are people who like the Diet Coke flavor and it's never going to go away. But it always tasted like malted battery acid to me and I was very unhappy with it. And so when they were like, here's Coke Zero, it's made with the original formula. And I remember specifically, I went to the local gas station and I got a 20-ounce bottle of it. And literally first time it came out, and I cracked it open and I took a chug as I was walking out of the store, and I immediately walked back in and bought like three more bottles because I was like, oh, this is it.
So, by the way, Coke, if you want to sponsor this, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Just kidding. All right. So a couple things I want to talk about, get into the book, and I'm going to avoid spoilers like the plague. Obviously when the moon hits your eye is all about, I don't think this is a spoiler. It's all about the moon turning into cheese.
Yeah, no,
it gives it away.
Yeah, it's on the cover. We can't hide that
part. Exactly. That is normally a more of a children's tale. I mean, you know, the moon made out of cheese and stuff like that. What made you decide, you know what, I can make this an adult book?
Part of it is just me being ornery. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, what's the assignment? Oh, okay. I will do that. But part of it is also, so here's the thing is, so we did Kaiju Preservation Society, which was a high concept idea, about people dealing with the fact that Godzilla is real. Then we did Starter Villain, which was, there are actual real live James Bond villains. And both of those, had done actually very, very well. Right? Better than we had expected. So when it came time to what's the next book, there were two things going on. One, we kind of wanted to continue that arc of high concept stuff. And second of all, we knew at the end of 2025 that there was going to be a new Old Man's War book, right? Because it's 2025 is the 20th anniversary of Old Man's War. We were doing the reissues of the books in trade paperback, and we knew that we were going to have a new book. So we didn't want to have another book that was going to be like a science fiction space opera sort of book. So between those two things, it made sense to continue the sort of high concept, normal people dealing with it thing. And honestly, I had thought of this idea more than a decade ago. And I was going to I thought I was going to write it earlier, and I've mentioned this before, but I will mention it again. But then Neal Stephenson came out with Seven Eves, which is very different book, very, very different book. But the concept of something has happened to the moon, and what has happened has been fairly arbitrary, but things will progress from there. And I was like, I don't want to do a moon book close to Neal Stephenson having done a moon book. So we got put in the back pocket. I wrote other things, and we ended up, I ended up going, oh, well, this would be a perfect idea to deal with now. And I always just kind of, I think it's fun that there's a certain aspect of my career, which is just absolutely random. Like, you know, the editor coming to me and being like, what's the next book? I was like, Moon Turns to Cheese. And they're like, fine, fine. This is you, fine. You know, I like that. I like that that is an aspect of my career. And at this point, nobody is surprised. Like explaining this book to people while I was writing it. What's happening? Well, for the entire lunar cycle, a moon turns to cheese. And they're like, yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. And of course you're doing it because you're, yeah, you know what I mean? People get used to that sort of thing from me. And I don't think that at this point it surprises them, whatever topic it is that I do. So moon cheese, why not?
I think that also talks about what level you've reached, though, the fact that you can just walk in there and say that, and they're like, yeah, okay, fine, it'll sell.
Yeah, no, I've been very, very fortunate in the course of my career. One, that Old Man's War came out and was an instant hit, right? Mm-hmm. That was the first novel of mine and came out in 2005. It was a big hit, got a lot of attention, and basically set the pace for... you know, it's like, we know we want more Scalzi stuff. Scalzi doesn't want to have to, write Old Man's War perpetually, you know, so he's going to do other things. And then what really made it take off was, basically Red Shirts, mm-hmm. Doing as well as it did, being a funny book, explicitly advertised and marketed as a humorous book, which was extremely difficult to do for a very long time in science fiction, but also just being basically random, meant that when it came time for other books, and I was just like, I'm going to do this thing. And they're like, fine. You know, mm-hmm. they got used to that zig and zag as opposed to it's, you know, it's October, it's time for another Old Man's War book. I don't have to write an Old Man's War book every year. I can do them when I think that there's a reason to do them. And that's actually a very fortunate thing to have, because I know a lot of science fiction and fantasy authors are always worried about, do they love me for me or do they love me for my series? And so I've been fortunate that... I have permission from my readers to do things other than just one Old Man's War book after another.
I think it helps too that I feel like it used to be a thing where if you wanted to go outside of a series, for instance, you with Old Man's War,
yeah,
or like for instance William Kent Kruger with a Cork O'Connor mystery series,
yeah,
like the publisher's like, no, we need another Jim Butcher, we need another Dresden book,
yeah, and yeah.
I feel like enough of you have had big hits outside of your series,
yeah,
that it's not as big of a stretch anymore as it used to be.
I think that that's right. I think it's also, I think there's also the understanding that writers do need to diversify their portfolio, right? Mm. I was talking with this with a fantasy author a while ago, and the fantasy writer had a big series, and I have, of course, all these different books. And we were talking about film and TV options because as one does. The point was made that the fantasy author had a very successful series, but it was one series. So he had one shot on goal, right? Mm-hmm. Where I have these multiple shots on goal. You know, I have the Lock-In series. I have the Interdependency series. I have Kaiju Preservation Society and Starter Villain and Old Man's War, obviously. And all of these things can be optioned. And maybe one of them will get to film and TV. And if they do, then it makes it easier for the rest of them. But this writer had the one thing, and so it had to work or, you know, right. or wouldn't. And I thought that that was a really interesting thing. And of course, I think it's very useful to write many different things. And I think we are lucky that our audience of readers now is more accepting of the idea that everything doesn't have to just be one series or one thing. I will say that, like, when Red Shirts came out and it ended up winning the Hugo, mm-hmm. I was both very happy to win the Hugo, but also kind of happy that it was not an Old Man's War book that won the Hugo right out of the gate, right? Because what that said was, from a creative and commercial point of view, that people were willing to sort of follow my lead when I did something a little different. And it was going to work out that way. Anyway, I remember way back when Tor said to me, basically, you could do every other book, an Old Men's War book, and we wouldn't care what the other book was. We would just publish it, which was an interesting kind of golden handcuffs sort of deal. Mm-hmm. Because on one hand, it's like how to be published forever. But on the other hand, the idea filled me with existential dread because, quite frankly, you know, we've all read the series where after a X number of books, we're like, it would have been better if you just let that alone for a while, right? And I feel very, very fortunate that, one, I didn't do that, obviously. But I feel very, very fortunate that with Old Man's War series, like I said, we're coming back with the seventh book in September of 2025. But we came back because I wanted to come back. I had a story that I wanted to tell in that universe with a character that I wanted to bring back from a previous book. And as it worked out, you know, we had a really nice place to put it because the 20th anniversary of the first book was, you know, happening. And so all the things came together that this was the right time, as opposed to, well, it's Tuesday, it's time to do another Old Man's War book. And that made a huge difference. And I do like the diversification of my career and the fact that when I do something goofy, like turn the moon to cheese, that there is potentially an audience for that.
And let me say, first of all, don't quote me on this, but if you are an Old Man's War fan, I believe September 18th is the date you need to put on your calendar.
Yeah.
I believe that's when that's dropping. Number two, though, I think, even if you don't worry about the optioning for TV and stuff like that, you're going to have John Scalzi fans who are going to buy every book you put out, no matter what it is. Mm. But you're going to have fans that would have never picked up Old Man's War because maybe that's not their thing.
Right.
But they're going to find you from Starter Villain or Red Shirts or something else like that. And now you're going to have fans that if you just continued with Old Man's War, would have never found you in the first place because that's not the type of book they pick up.
Right. And I think that that's a very cogent point. Old Man's War started off as military science fiction. The first two books are explicitly military science fiction and the rest are kind of space opera. But there's a certain type of writer or a certain type of reader that's just not their bag. And I think that that's fine. And there's no reason for people not to have the preferences that they have. But you're right. I mean, I have the people who every book that comes out brings in a new crowd of people who just show up. Starter Villain, which was the most recent book prior to Moon, did extremely well. And a lot of it came down to the fact that it was not a James Bond parody, but it was a sort of different book. That cover with the cat on the cover, literally, I'm on my book tour signing books and people would come up and they would be like, I don't know who you are. And I've never read anything that you've done before. And I don't read science fiction, but this cover. And so every time I think about that, I bless Tristan Elwell, who is the cover artist, because he just did such a spectacular version of the cover for us. But yeah, every time that you put out something is an opportunity for new people to come in. And now there's the backlist. There's a backlist now of 18 or 19 books, not counting novellas and short stories and everything else, that then they can go explore. So every book is a door. Every book is an entryway. And having that diversification of doors has been critical to me having the career that I do have.
And I have to admit, I have not gotten to Starter Villain yet, but I did want to read it just from that cover.
Yeah.
That cover and title together. I think it's the combo.
It's
just something about it.
I think it is a platonic ideal of a book cover. And I've actually done this where I put it up and I'm like, you know, take a look at this thing. One, the cat draws you in, right? Second of all, up at the top is a tagline that says, meet the new boss. And if you are 50 and over, it means one thing. And if you're, you know, 50 and under or under 50, then it means a completely different thing. But either way, it draws you in. You scroll down, Starter Villain, which is a great title. And then John Scalzi. So people are like, oh, John Scalzi. So bang, 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 just as communicating what's going on with the book. It is just about a perfect cover. And I estimate, and this is completely anecdotal, that I think about 10 to 15% of my sales are just for that book is just simply off that cover.
Well, the internet does like cats.
The internet does like cats. I'm very happy with actually this cover as well, too. You know, the whole idea.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the moon and of course, the astronaut taking a selfie, which is very 2020s.
Yes. I do have to say, you were talking about the fact that you started Old Man's War in 2005. And as somebody who was, and again, I'm almost your age, 71, that's when I was born.
Yeah.
It sounds like I'm like, man, it feels like you've been writing longer than that. And then I have to stop and think, it's like, that was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Things like, you're probably the same age I am as, like, you know, the 70s were something, the 80s were something, the 90s were something. But like the 2000s is all just like 2000 to 2025, and my brain has just been one decade.
Yeah, no, it's been a big blur, and it is weird. Every once in a while, so one, I drive my wife crazy by the fact that I will be like, I will listen, yeah, generally, but specifically, like we'll be listening to something from the, you know, a song from the 80s, like Take On Me by AHA or something like that. I will say to her, this song is as far away from us in the timeline as Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy was from the 1980s. And she's like, why do you do this to me? What is going on? But yeah, as you get older, I think it just things are begin to, like, you know, squish and mash and stuff like that. Someone was mentioning 2000, something came out in 2007. And I'm like, it can't possibly have been that long ago, 18 years. But it is, it's just, time becomes, much more, fluid and sort of elastic the older, you get. And it blows my mind that stuff that came out that when I was an adult, is now old enough to be nostalgia, like emo music, yeah. Right? You know, it's like, you know, My Chemical Romance, or Fallout Boy, you know, it's like going on or the, now they have emo cruises, right? Which means that the young scrappy emo fans are now old enough to afford to go on a cruise. And I have nothing against cruises. I am literally going on the Joko cruise in a week. So cruises are fun, but it is a certain type a person, mostly at a certain age, who can afford to get on a boat and be there for a week. So, time is a thing. And I do think about the fact that I've had a career as a professional novelist for 20 years, but I had a career for 15 years as a professional writer before that. Right. And just adding it all up and all the things that I've done over the course of my career and the course of my life. And I'm just like, how did I have time to do all of that? And the answer is time happens. It just it just does. It just catches up with you.
Well, I don't think it helped. I swear everything post COVID too has just been one year.
Like, oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, the whole COVID thing was just very much of a, why is this happening? And it was a very strange, fluid time. I was actually on a cruise when I found out about COVID. Like I was on the Joko cruise because I go on it annually because I'm on staff on it. And I remember people coming up to me going, did you hear about Tom? Did you hear about Tom? Did you hear about Tom? And I'm like, who the hell is Tom? And why do I need to hear about him? And it turned out to be Tom Hanks. He was one of the first people, first celebrities to get the COVID. And the reason people were telling me about it was I had lunch with Tom Hanks like a couple of weeks before I went on the cruise. So then the people who run the cruise is like, when did you have lunch? Because there's a question that I could have been patient zero on a cruise for COVID. And it turned out that it was just outside of that. But then, you know, everything went, you know, wacky from there. Like we were the last of the second to last cruise to actually be able to dock.
That's what I would have been worried about.
Yeah, it was us and an 80s cruise that came in the next day. And after that, they were like, no more. If you're on a boat, I don't know what to tell you. You're going to be on that boat for a while.
By the way, there was a nice subtle name drop. I like that. That was
my friend Tom.
All right. So getting back to the book, I promise we are talking about the book.
Sure.
One of the things I noticed about this book is you tell it from an almost ridiculous amount of points of view. There's so many characters in there. When you started this book, was it always going to be that many points of view, or is that something that grew as you kept coming up with something? Oh, I need this.
No. It was very much of always meant to be kind of a Robert Altman style novel, right? For those of you who don't know the reference I just made, Robert Altman was director primarily in the 70s and 80s. And one of the things that he was famous for was basically having many, many characters talking over each other and having multiple storylines and all that sort of stuff. So I knew that the moon was turning to cheese. I knew I wanted to take place over a lunar cycle, which means that it structured itself into basically 29 chapters and change. Right. Mm-hmm. The moon shines on us all. And basically, I wanted to have a whole bunch of people have different, you know, reactions to it. The structure of it was always going to be a chapter a day and looking at various people in various stations of life dealing with the fact that the moon has turned to cheese. So, for me, that was always kind of the attraction of it. And I was comparing this to fix-up novels, you know, from the 50s and 60s, where a writer would take a whole bunch of short stories, put some narrative thread through them to connect them, even if they were not connected before. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like jam all these stories together, a little bit of narrative thread, suddenly Martian Chronicles, right? That sort of thing. In many ways, this is a fix-up novel without anything to fix up. It was just literally always built to be lots of different narratives. Now, you can do things like someone who's a minor character in one chapter will become a main character in another chapter and all of this sort of stuff. And so there is a thread of continuity of characters through the book. But for me, the interest of it was this is something that affects each and every person on the planet. You can't ignore the moon has turned to cheese. So to focus on just one or two people for this thing made no sense. I wanted the broad spectrum of experience within the boundaries of the United States, because that's where I am and where I'm more comfortable writing. I would have exposed my ignorance to have a character from Ulaanbaatar talk at length about this, but you know, someone from Delaware I could definitely do.
Although you could have written off the research trip as a business expense.
Yes, so this is the great thing about being an author. Everything is basically a tax deduction. I just bought a very expensive chair that I'm going to put into my office. And I'm like, it's going into my office. I need it for work. It's,
is it the starter villain chair? No, I'm just kidding.
It is the starter villain chair. It is, in fact, in starter villain, I talk about an Eames chair. Which mm-hmm. I've been coveting an Eames chair for a very long time. My friend, who is not helpful at all, just sent me a link where apparently there's a 25% off sale. And that was yesterday. And I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I realized just how much money I spent. So please buy my book.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd love to have a Mavix chair myself, but I need like the 90% off for the good one with the lumbar right. and the heating pad and everything.
Right, so. right. No, everyone's, but this is the thing. And this is another aspect we were talking about being older and, you know, 50s is not super, super old, but it's not young either. But when you get to your 50s, you really appreciate a good chair, right? Yeah. Like there's something about it. It's I'm looking forward to this chair the way I think some people in their 20s and 30s might be looking forward to a new car, right?
Possible.
Yeah, it's just like sitting and be like, oh yes, because my back, right? And so, yeah. No, I splurged. Please buy my book.
Yeah, let's face it. We are at the age where it's almost impossible to stand up or sit down without making some sort of noise.
Oh yeah, the grunt. Yeah, the grunt. Yep. Yeah, you're always grunting, and your pets are looking at you like, "What are you trying to say? I don't understand you."
Well, it's like I have a dorky little 2013 Scion XB, mm-hmm. but I can tell you right now, the biggest thing I love about that car, because it does not handle corners worth a darn.
I feel like
you're going to fall over. But it's the only car I've ever had where I sit into it, I step out of it, it's not up, it's not down, it's like the perfect height.
It's a lateral. It's a yep. lateral move.
I just go sideways and I'm in my car.
I felt that way. We bought, so 2003, my old car died and I wanted a Honda Element.
Okay.
Way back when. But my wife fell in love with the Odyssey minivan. And I was like, okay, we're going to get a minivan. I did get a personalized plate that said not cool, because when you get a, because when you get a minivan, you just accept that about yourself. And then the same thing, it's like in and out, super easy, so much space for, you know, everything that you would need a car for. You know, I hate that I fell in love with my minivan. Mm-hmm. yet, it was just so, so convenient to have. And like I said, that's the thing, as you get older, things that are all of a sudden more practical, like a good mattress or, you know, a nice chair or a really good pair of kitchen scissors, because you never needed kitchen scissors when you were younger. And all of a sudden you get them and you're like, how have I been living my entire life without kitchen scissors? I've been living a lie. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to be the first one to coin this, but I feel like, you know, you hit about late 40s, mid 50s, and it's like comfort is the new style.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm loving, by the way, that the fact that this conversation has just gone so far afield. I mean, it's okay that we, you know, it's like we will get to the book and we will talk about science fiction.
I've still got a couple of book questions. No, I promise.
Absolutely. Let's just keep going. But the fact that we're like, you know, but really a good chair, kids. Yeah. Get in early on the good share thing. That's all I can tell you.
Yeah, I feel like you wouldn't probably be getting the same conversation if you were on here with like a 20-year-old. But
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it's right. fine.
One thing I did want to bring up before I forget about this. There's a section towards the end. I'm not going to get into details because, again, no spoilers.
Right.
But I thought it was interesting. You have a conversation that takes place in the middle of a church.
Uh-huh.
And I will say, for anybody who's, you know, thinking about reading this book, or in case my mother stumbles across this, the language is a little bit more colorful than normally be deemed appropriate in such a setting.
Right.
That is a spoiler. That's a warning for her. But I thought that the speech that you had by James after that outburst, and also the prayer that he had home later at home after his wife goes to bed.
Yeah.
I thought those were so profound and so spot on, and I could see a preacher going, man, I wished I'd thought of that.
Yeah.
That was what prompted that chapter for you, because I thought the writing was spot on.
Well, it was without spoiling anything, mm-hmm. the book is roughly divided into two aspects. And it's the first 2 weeks and the second 2 weeks of the lunar cycle. And something mm-hmm. happens in between those that makes for a really useful dividing point. And that's the mm-hmm. only spoiler. The aspect of it is that just in a general sense, the moon turning to cheese causes fear, doubt, and uncertainty, right? And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is that it's not just the scientists that have to deal with it. It's not just mm-hmm. the politicians that have to deal with it. The United States is one of the most deeply religious countries on the planet. If you are going to try to portray all levels of American life and your story, then it makes sense to have the religious aspect of it as well. And I think that's really important that within the context of the book, everybody in the book is treating this seriously. They all know it's mm-hmm. ridiculous, right? The moon has turned to cheese, but they have to be living their lives and they have to be dealing with stuff. And for a pastor, this is a hugely profound thing. There's nothing in any religious text that deals specifically with, you know, something like this. Mm-hmm. And so they have to deal with that, not only theologically, but in the ecclesiastical sense of tending to their flock, right? Mm-hmm. Because their flock is having, you know, doubts, concerns, and everything else as well. I'm an agnostic. I don't believe there's a God, but I'm, you know, humble enough to know that I don't know everything. But lots of people do believe, and just because I am, agnostic does not mean that I should necessarily treat religion as a ridiculous concept. Mm-hmm. I got to treat it with the gravity of the people who actually believe in it. And that was an aspect of it while I was writing it. It also helps, you know, quite frankly, I mean, I live in a very small community that has 1,800 people and 10 churches, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when we moved here in 2001, they're like, well, which church will you attend? And I didn't have the heart to tell them. I was like, I'm going to sleep in on Sunday, you know, and I think God will understand. We actually own a church now. The old Methodist church yep. went up for sale, and we were looking for office space. And so we now own a church. And when we owned the church, everybody who had ever been there, who had gone to services there, who had been married there, who had a funeral there, all that sort of stuff, you know, then came to us, and they were full of the apprehension of what we were going to do with the church when we finally renovated it, because it needed renovation. We opened it up to the community and let them look around, and they were just so happy that we kept the church rather than, you know, tear it down and mm-hmm. do something else with it. So I am very, even as someone who is agnostic, I'm very aware of the importance of a church and the role of a community. So that I think reflects, that is reflected in the fact of that chapter. I don't know that I would have been able to write that chapter if I didn't in fact own a church building, because so much of that just comes through.
Perfect. I do have to say, I don't know if you need the side hustle, but I can see right now, if you ever need some extra money, I bet you if you got ordained, there'd be some people loving to get married there at the church.
Well, I am actually ordained. I've been ordained for years through the Universal Life Church. We are not, we've had people, when we bought the church, people came out of, not, I don't want to say out of the woodwork, because that sounds like derogatory, but they just came out and they're like, can we rent the church? You know, because somebody wanted to use it for services and all that sort of stuff. And we have said no for a couple of reasons. One, because we are actually actively using it as office space. And we plan to do events there that will be open for the public, but they will be how we decide to do it. But the other thing is that if we start renting it out, then it is a commercial venue. And if it is a commercial venue, then a whole other set of rules apply to it. And it's a 100-year-old church. It's, you know, it was not ADA compliant because it was you know, backdated into the regulations and also churches. But since it's not that anymore, if we start using it as a rental space, then we have to make it ADA compliant, which we want to do, but that is a long-term project because it will cost tens of thousands of dollars to do it.
Gotcha. So in other words, buy his book.
Yeah, please, please buy my book.
And one of the things I want to touch on, this wasn't really a question, but I think you kind of already alluded to it. To me, this is going to sound weird, but to me, When the Moon Hits Your Eye is not a science fiction book.
Yeah.
It is a novel that has a science fiction background.
Yeah.
But it's much more about the stories, like you said, all the people, the politicians, the scientists, the religious people.
Yeah.
It's all about how they react to something that religion doesn't have an answer for, science doesn't have an answer for, the average person on the street doesn't have an answer for.
Yeah.
I think like normal science fiction books, you have to have something that you can fix with a science fiction hammer and screwdriver. And this book is not that. That's not what it is. It's just got that background, which kind of loosely ties into the thing that you brought up earlier. Kaiju Preservation Society, starter villain, and When the Moon Hits Your Eye are in the possibly loosest sense of the word, a trilogy.
Yeah.
But it's based on what they're about, not about the shared universe or the shared story or the shared characters.
Right. It's about the high concept thing and people dealing with it. And I do think it wasn't the intent, obviously, when I started writing Kaiju, but it ends up being the thing that those three books, because they sequentially came out one after the other, really do sort of make a triptych of themes. And what has been interesting is watching people struggle to categorize this particular book. I am known as a science fiction writer. It's going to get shelved in the science fiction, as a science fiction book, and the moon turning to cheese just feels science fictional anyway. But you're correct. It is not a book about the science per se. It is about, people dealing with what is essentially, if you look at it, a thing that affects their life, but that they had no agency in. And certainly that is a thing that people understand. No matter what generation you are or what age that you've lived in, we have always been enthralled to events that we had no control over, that weren't necessarily things that we would have wanted or expected, but we have to deal with them anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, Great Depression, World War II, Cold War, whatever it is that, you know, everybody is dealing with, and Lord knows we're dealing with things now. But all of these things, you put them together, everybody has to deal with things that are, that they had no hand in. And so in that sort of sense, that's what this book is about. Something has happened. We have to deal with it. The thing that I have them deal with is absurd, but they cannot treat it as an absurdity because it actually affects their life. Is it science fiction? It will be classified as science fiction because I am a science fiction writer. Is it fantasy? Mm-hmm. It is kind of fantasy. Someone described it as magical realism. And I think Borges will, you know, and Gabriel Garcia will be like, you know, rolling their, eyes at that. But it's also not inaccurate either. It is in a very, very weird category of a fantastical idea that is, the impetus for kitchen table drama.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was trying to remember. Yeah, it was okay. So I kind of, when you were talking about that, I was trying to remember, I think it was, I couldn't remember the name of the book, but it's John Sanford wrote a book called Saturn Run.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think they had the exact same problem with because he's a mystery author.
Yeah.
And this was set around, you know, space and Saturn and aliens and stuff. And then, like, nobody knew where to put it. I think it ended up getting shelved in fiction at the bookstore.
Right.
I was at because they had no idea what to do with it.
Yeah. But this is actually, this is a point that I like making about science fiction. The great thing about science fiction and being a science fiction writer is how capacious the field is, that I can, in fact, write just about anything I want. People will be like, yeah, sure, that's science fiction. Because, you know, I can write, a noir in it, like I did with like The Dispatcher, or crime novels, like I did with the Lock-In series, or funny, humorous books like I did with Red Shirts, and so on and so forth. And it all kind of fits into the science fiction milieu. Whereas if you are known for being a literary fiction person, and all of a sudden you write something that is explicitly science fictional, then you have an argument on your hands about where it's going to be, where it's going to be shelved. I remember when I spoke with Tor right around the time that I did that first ridiculously long contract with them in 2005. That's the 13 book contract. And one of the things that I said is I don't want to like make the leap to be a mainstream author. What I want to do is I want to be science fiction's ambassador to the mainstream. I want to be the person who writes the books that you can give to the person who says they don't read science fiction and they don't know what they think about science fiction, or they find science fiction too intimidating, and you give them one of my books and they're like, oh, well, I can read this. This is makes perfect sense. So, you know, once again, with Kaiju and with Star Devillain and with Moon Hits Your Eye, these are all science fictional books in a very sort of broad sense, but they're also books that you could give to someone who hasn't read science fiction, and they're not going to get lost in them. They're not going to get lost in the terminology, I should say. They'll get lost in the story, which is what you want them to do. And then they'll come out of it being like, well, why was I intimidated by science fiction for so long? This is fun stuff. And that's like, cool. And here are all these other amazing writers for you to try out. Like, you know, I get you through the door, and then, you know, here's Mary Robinette Cole. Here's N.K. Jemisin. Here is James S.A. Core. Here are all the other stuff that's going on that now you don't feel like you are going to be intimidated by.
Perfect. All right. So I don't want to get into any spoilers. I think we already kind of touched on one of the last things I was going to say was about how fun it would be to take on these topics instead of your normal sci-fi fare like Old Man's War. But I think we've kind of gone in depth on that. I do want to say one of the other things I did love about this, and again, you talked about the premise, and I won't say cheesy because that's too easy. but, you know, it is a very corny premise on its surface.
Sure.
But the fact, like you said, that it is admitted in the book to the people who are dealing with this that this is utterly ridiculous.
Yep.
But you also managed to get in each of those, because it's a multi-POV, you've got those different characters. You've got the ones that are like, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, the sky is falling, you know, they're panicking. You've got the ones like, yeah, we're screwed. You know, yeah. But you've also got the ones who are like, yeah, okay, I know we got to deal with this, but that doesn't change the fact that my term paper's due on Tuesday. You know, those are the people that are still walking through the end of life, or you know, walking through your normal everyday life.
Yeah.
And so I feel like everybody who reads this book can at least see part of themselves in at least one character, which I think helps bring it out to the masses.
Sure, sure. And again, that was intentional. Like, I did want to have a broad range of characters, so that whatever the situation was, sooner or later you can see yourself in it. And I do think, again, many, many years ago, I did a TV show where I was talking about what would happen if aliens came from space and, you know, landed and, you know, and the answer is, one, it would absolutely change the world. Two, you would still have to take out the trash. Right. Yeah. And quite honestly, if you look at so much of my writing, it exists between those two points. You know, incredible life-changing thing has happened. Also, I have bills, right? And the interplay between those two things has always been fascinating to me, and I can feel it as a human going through the world. I have an absolutely bizarre life, right? I write things for a living. I go from place to place talking about the thing that I wrote about. I have fans. Famous people know me. I know famous people. I get to see the world. My life is, in the best sense, absolutely absurd, right? Mm-hmm. Also, I have to clean the cat box on a weekly basis. I have bills to pay. I do actually have to write the books. If I don't, and that just means sitting in a hole, you know, and typing them out and making sure that they get done. The fantastic aspects of my life exist side by side by the absolutely mundane aspects of my life. And I find the interplay between those two things to be incredible and fascinating. And I can't believe that, like, this is actually my life. So when it comes to writing stuff, that interplay fascinates me as well. The idea of, the mundane world wrapped up in the fantastical and how everybody kind of navigates through that. I think I can write about it endlessly and probably will until, I'm 70, which is when my contract runs out. So
well, that sounds like perfect timing then.
Yeah, exactly.
So just as a reminder, this drops Tuesday, is that right?
No, it drops, actually, we're a little bit early on it. It comes out on March 25th. So
we're earlier than I thought.
Yeah, no, okay. we're a little bit early, but that's okay because you know what? You can pre-order this book now from your favorite bookstore. I of course always encourage people, if you have a local indie bookstore, to pre-order it from them because they will love the business. And it's great for both me and my publisher. We know how many people want things. But if you don't have a good local indie, then, a good local chain or, buying it online or all that sort of stuff, it makes sense. But pre-orders are great because that lets us gauge what we are what people want. And also, then it shows up on your door the day that it's supposed to come out. And you're like, oh, I bought this like 4 months ago. Who knew? As far as it goes. But you're a little bit early, but you're perfectly timed for the pre-orders. Just perfect. Just pre-order, people.
I knew it was coming close, and I knew I talked about you about doing it in March, and then I think you're just booked in March.
It's unbelievable. No, this I am doing... I started 2 days ago. The next week is literally every day is a podcast or interview. Mm-hmm. And then I go on a cruise for Old Man's War, and I come back and I do more podcasts and interviews. Then the tour happens, and that's 2 week tour. And then every other weekend, all the way through like the 1st of June, is a convention or book festival. Absolutely no rest for the wicked. And then in September, because I have another book coming out, I have two books this year, I get to do it all over again. So somewhere in there, I have to write another book. We'll see what happens with that.
And this is where I usually remind people too, to be nice to your authors. John Scalzi right now is talking to us about a book that he probably finished writing a year ago or maybe longer.
Yeah.
So, you're like knee deep into either Old Man's War or maybe even the book that's coming out after that, if you've already started writing that one.
Yeah. The Old Man's War book is actually, I turned it in. Yeah. May 19th is when I finished this book. Old Man's War, I finished actually on the 21st of January. Okay. And then, so I basically gave myself a month off to sleep. and to catch up on some other things. But yeah, now it is the time where I'm like, okay, what is it that I'm actually going to write for next year? And there are a couple things that are, showing themselves. But it is very interesting to try to write a book and also to do all the travel that I do. I did not know when I started writing books that it would involve as much travel and personal appearances as it does. And this is not a complaint. I do get to see the world, and I am a huge ham. So going and doing events and doing interviews and stuff like that is right in my wheelhouse. So I'm very fortunate to be at the level where this is of my life. And also when it's done, I hide in my, I hide in my office for like a week and just introvert like you would not believe.
Well, I think even extroverts need to decompress once in a while.
But, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So again, like, think anything else we talk about is probably going to get too close to spoilery territory. So let me do a few wrap up questions.
Okay.
First and foremost, is there a skill, hobby, or accomplishment that you wish more people knew about you so that you could talk about something besides writing once in a while?
The thing is that we talked earlier about COVID, right? Yeah. And during the COVID times, everybody had a project. And my project was I built a little tiny music studio down in my basement where I just like literally was like, I'm going to spend money and I'm going to buy all the guitars and all of that sort of stuff. And so that was my COVID project was not making music. My COVID project was spending money on the things to make music. And so eventually I got to the point where I was like, I really can't buy any more instruments. I actually have to start using them. So if you go to Spotify and you type in my name, you will find quite a number at this point of weird, noodly, ambient electronic music that I have put out. And the way I describe it to people is that it is the music that a middle-aged white man would make. And all of my fans, my dozen of fans, singular dozen of fans, are all middle-aged white dudes, you know, who are like, I like what you've done with your synthesizer sounds here. You know, it's absolutely delightful. I will not be opening up for Taylor Swift anytime soon. Gotcha. She'll never call me and be like, Sabrina Carpenter broke her leg. We need noodly middle-aged ambient music. But I enjoy it. I've been having fun doing it, and it's been fun learning a new skill that's both creative and has absolutely no consequence if I never do anything with it. Like, nobody will ever think of John Scalzi musician before they think of John Scalzi author, right? I can put out something and nobody cares if it's good or bad. They just, you know, it's absolutely no pressure, and I absolutely love it. So if you want to experience my noodly ambient musings, go to your favorite streaming service, type John Scalzi, and you will find it.
I think we need to just put a band together, though. I've talked to quite a few authors that do music on the side as well. I can see it now. We'll get you, Nat Cassidy, and Josh Mallerman together, and we'll just call it like the Inkwells or something.
It's hilarious because you can't see it because I intentionally have this sort of like, but there are right now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 guitars in my office. Right. And they are just, and they range from just like weird little mini tellies to an SG over here that is painted like a psychedelic version of the Little Prince. So, So as far as it goes, I actually had to promise Chrissy that I would not purchase any more guitars in 2025 because there's absolutely no reason for me to have any more. I actually have to play them now. And I'm like, fair.
And you can only really play one at a time, usually.
Right. But here's a fun thing. If you want to see a ridiculous, ridiculous guitar, go to Google, type Scalzi the Beast, and you will. All I'm saying is that you look, when you look at that guitar, the question that will come up is absolutely why. Here, someone says, I get the feeling Red Shirts must have had some connection to Will Wheaton. He did narrate it. But I knew Will before he narrated it. And so certainly the fact that, you know, a good friend of mine was a Star Trek person meant that I was able to get some insight into what it was like to be on the an actual Star Trek TV series. It's funny because I did, when I wrote the book and I just was thinking about who I needed to dedicate it to, he was one of them. And that made it really easy, because like, you know, here, Will, it's dedicated to you. Also, will you narrate it, please?
Wow. There's a little butter on that bread.
Yeah, just a little bit of butter on that bread.
All right. One other thing I like to ask before we get, obviously, what are you reading now?
I have been reading the Martian Contingency, which is the latest of the Lady Astronaut series from Mary Robinette Cole. Okay. For two reasons. One, because she's one of my favorite writers, and she's also a really good friend. And the second thing is that she and I are doing an event together on the 23rd of March in Columbus, Ohio, at the Public Library. And it would be really incredibly embarrassing if I came to the event not having read her book, because I know that she's already read When the Moon Hits Your Eye, right? Gotcha. No pressure at all. So I'd be like, show up and be like, so your book, I didn't read it, but could you tell us a little bit about it? Yeah, that would be disrespectful. So, but as it happens, it's also an extremely good book, because of course it is. It's a Lady Astronaut book, and those books have won all the awards and so on and so forth.
Well, you've mentioned her twice now, so I think you like her work.
Yeah, yes.
Is there a question that you expected to be asked that you weren't, or just something that you wanted to talk about? This is a freebie.
See, this has always been a really interesting question to me, because I used to be a film critic, and I would do tons and tons of interviews. And so I always just laid out the questions that I wanted to ask. So for me, it's always been, when I'm interviewed, I just assume that you've asked the questions that you wanted to ask. And so I keep my brain this like blank space for just whatever it is that you wanted to text. So I never think about why aren't you asking this question or that question or anything other? The one thing I will say is that having for like many years, for like over a decade, been the person who is on the other side of the interview thing, and then having that switch over time has been fascinating. Like the whole thing of being, I think it, one, gives me sympathy for the people who have to interview me. And I try to actually be a good interview, because I have been in the seat where like I've interviewed a Oscar winning director who only answered in monosyllables, right? No matter what it was that you asked him, it's like, yes, no, no, yes. And I'm like, why are we even here? Like, I actually had to call the publicist back and be like, I can't run this interview. He was a terrible, terrible interview. And they're like, yeah, we know, he's been doing that in the entire time. So, you know, I have always made it my, mission not to be the difficult interviewee. I like to try to give value for your questions. So I never think about what it is that I would have asked. I always just bring it to, what have you asked and how can I best answer it in a way that would be interesting and amusing and doesn't waste your time or the time of the people who are actually like going to see the interview or read it or listen to it or, whatever. So basically that's my way of saying, no, I don't have any questions for you.
Which is fine. I have to blame Elise Stevens for that. She was my second interview.
Yeah.
And she'd made some comment about, I think when I kind of asked her the question, And she brought up, for instance, when I asked about, do you have any other hobbies or stuff like that? And so sometimes that open-ended question brings up other questions and I'm like, man, I need to ask somebody else that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good idea to ask. It'd be like, what else have you been thinking about? And I think the thing is, it can be like we had an extremely discursive conversation today, right? Mm. We talked about beverages, we talked about churches, we went into great detail about the importance of a comfy chair, right? So yeah, I mean, it could be something that's like, no, but I need to talk about my book more. One of the other things is I am 20 years into my novel writing career. I am not worried anymore that people won't read my books. I mean, that sounds sort of egotistical, but in the sense of the concerns that a new writer has, or that someone who's really trying to shoot their shot have, are not the same concerns that I have now. What I really want to do when I have an interview is actually have a good time in the interview. So the fact that we went way far afield on comfy chairs and soda has made this actually quite a good time for me. So thank you for indulging me.
No, I started this. My first one was Shauna McGuire, February 2022.
Yeah, yeah.
And I started this because COVID had hit. I used to work at a little local independent bookstore, and all the authors, whenever they came to town, would come there. And I just missed being able to go to the author events. And I'm like, well, screw it, I'll make my own.
So, when in doubt.
I get to talk to people like you. That's the whole reason I've got this channel.
Yeah.
So last question, and I always ask everybody this, shout out, and I know you're a big fan because you've already mentioned it, shout out to an independent bookstore that you love.
Oh, Jane Mary's Book Center in Troy, Ohio, which is basically my home bookstore. Every year at holiday season, we do a thing where people can call them up and request signed and personalized books from me. And we do that. And I do that for two reasons. One, just because it's a simple way for me to do it. And second of all, because why wouldn't you support your independent local bookstore if you are a writer? And they're my independent local bookstore. And not only that, but you know, every time I'm in town, I will go and I will make sure all their stock is signed. When I have a new book come out, like Moon Hits Your Eye, I will be doing a number of things. I'll be doing a book tour. I'm doing a thing with Subterranean Press where I will go up and sign and personalize books and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, if you've somehow managed to miss me elsewhere, you can call up Jane Mary's Books Center and be like, could you ask him to personalize this or sign it? And I will do it. It might take a little while because I have to actually travel into town to do it. But it will eventually get done. And of course I'm happy to do that because they're wonderful people. And it's just so much a thing that I think writers should do. You should absolutely support the bookstores that you have in your community.
Exactly. And every time I have a book that I just want to have a copy as a trophy on my shelf, I always usually if I want it signed, I will find out who that author, you know, what's their local bookstore, and I will try to buy it from them.
Yes. So. Yes, absolutely. The other thing is that I would say to people, though, since I will be on tour for this book, if you could call any of those bookstores that I will be making an appearance at and ask them to do that. They will be more than happy to put a book in a pile for me to sign and then ship it to you and so on and so forth. So any of those avenues will work. But when in doubt, Jane Mary's Book Center in Troy, Ohio.
Yeah, I think I got a Jim Butcher and a Jen Lyons that were personalized, and they got both of those on a book tour, as like called the store that they were hitting. So
yep, absolutely.
All right, perfect. Well, I think that is gonna wrap it up. We had some comments in the chat, but not a lot of questions. So big important days to remember: March 25th.
Yep.
Although you can pre-order now.
Yep.
And September 18th, if you're an old Man's War fan. Again, that pre-order will, I mean, it may not be up now, but it will be happening. They always
the pre-order definitely is up. Also, Subterranean Press again, is already doing their thing where if you go, you can get a signed and personalized book through them. But the number of editions they have for that is limited. So if you want to do it that way, you should do it quickly because they will run out.
Gotcha. So Subterranean Press, if you want that one, get a move on.
Yes.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody who stopped in watching. I also want to thank John for hopping on. I appreciate him taking time out of his day.
Sure.
And getting on my schedule here. And we are really looking forward to that. And I, like I said, I did finish those two, but I am going to be getting to Starter Villain. I've been wanting to get to that one.
Excellent. However,
my TBR is large and sentient and staring at me.
That is the great thing about books. They are on your schedule, right? So when you get to them is when you get to it.
But so tough.
It's now officially backlist. Don't worry about it.
But at the exit, because that book cover sold me though. I now that I know it's part of the trilogy too, and I've read one and three. I've got to get to two.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks again, everybody. Dennis got a little wave. Author Dennis Myers in there popping in to wave at you. he was in. All right. Appreciate it. And we will catch you next time. I don't have the date in front of me, but I know that I've got James J. Butcher coming up March 3rd, I think. Don't quote me on that. Check the website. And don't forget to check out John Scalzi's website again. Probably the most prolific poster on Blue Sky that I know. And if you love cats, the Instagram is the place to be.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one.